Hi, folks. This is Denise Howell. And next up on This Week in Law, we've got two, count them, two law professors for you, Eric Goldman and Stephen Jamar. Evan Brown and me, we're going to talk about Siri getting sued for not necessarily delivering on what its ads promise, AT&T and its would-be settlement. Yahoo claims to own all of Facebook, at least as far as its patents go. We're going to talk about IP and social justice, an update on Section 230, and lots, lots more next on Twill.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 153, recorded March 16, 2012. Siri sucker suit. Hey folks, Denise Howell here, and you've tuned in for This Week in Law. We're thrilled to have you here because we've got an awesome panel today. Truly, truly awesome. In fact, never not awesome, because we've got Eric Goldman joining us once again, one of our very favorite panelists on Twill. Hello, Eric. Great to see you.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Wonderful, as always, to see you on the show. We're thrilled you could join us. That is just one of the plethora of law professors we have joining us today, because also from Howard University, we have Stephen Jamar. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, glad to be here. Sounds interesting.
It should be. We've got some really great stories to discuss with you both today, and also with Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, how's it going? This is one of those back to law school episodes of Twill, so hope we can stay sharp, right, Denise?
Yes, I know. Evan and I were sending each other nervous emails before the show going, God, I hope they aren't in a quizzing mood, but we'll just
feeling
have to
see. Feeling all Socratic.
Yes, how things go with our wonderful law prof panel. We're abundantly blessed with you guys today, so we're thrilled to have you here. Professor Jamar is one of the co-founders of the Institute of Intellectual Property and Social Justice at Howard, which I didn't know about until you and I started corresponding, Professor Jamar. So it's wonderful to know about the work you've been doing there. Can you fill us in a bit on why you started the Institute and what is the connection between IP and social justice?
About 10 years ago, Latif Matima, our director of the Institute, came to me with this idea and said he'd like me to work with him on it. We were the two main IP professors at the law school. There's all sorts of social justice issues relating to IP. The easiest one that's most obvious is drugs and drug availability and drug pricing. What should that be for people to get access to these very important drugs? From our perspective, there's lots of issues that relate to access to music, derivative works, hip-hop music. Who should have the copyright? Who should benefit? Is it going to be the is it going to be the big company? Is it going to be the developer of the music and so on? So we find all sorts of IP connections to social justice.
I was reading a great article, and of course, as a law professor, you guys have ample occasion to publish your scholarly thoughts and ideas. This one was from a couple of years back, I believe, and it's all about the connection between IP and social justice. And you conclude with a ringing thought: we ought not examine intellectual property only from a property perspective or only from the perspective of the creator or funder or exploiter of the rights or only from the perspective of conservative stare decisis. Instead, we should examine intellectual property issues from the perspective of social good and the public interest and the interests of all groups involved. We need intellectual property law to be a transformative force for social and economic justice, like the statutory actions of Congress in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the actions of the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education 50 years ago. That's a really interesting way, and one that I don't hear much of thinking about intellectual property law, that it's not just a property right, but it really has this role in our society to promote the progress, as you also call out from one of the Supreme Court decisions you discuss. So what is it that the Institute is doing to further those ends?
Too much. I'm way too busy.
Mm-hmm.
For the last 10 years, we've been doing a conference where it's also CLE, so you get credit for it for your continuing legal education requirements, which brings in judges and lawyers as well as academics and practitioners. We've used that as a showcase for the relatively few African-American and other minorities in the IP profession and as a place for us to preach to the Federal Circuit judges. And I think this time we had 3 Federal Circuit judges and we had 7 federal judges total at the conference presenting. We get name partners at some of the bigger firms present. We had Capos from the USPTO come and present. And what we see is an opportunity for us to go ahead and explain to them what's going on in IP and social justice. One of my favorite events was 3 years after we'd had a partner presenting at our conference, he came up to him and said, "I didn't understand what you guys were about until this year." Well, that's what we've been doing, is getting it's entered the dialogue. It's become part of what people are speaking. We get calls from congressional staffers now. The International Trade Commission just changed its rules to require for any special Section 301 rules that are proposed or actions that are brought, people have to brief the issues of impact on the public interest. And so we have had an actual effect on people's minds and their approaches to things, and we just keep getting busier. We were invited by WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, to become an NGO affiliate, and so we're going to be starting to be involved in that as well. We just did a presentation last fall, our second annual one, co-sponsored with the U.S. Patent Office, where they're trying to reach out to include more people in the patenting process through a number of initiatives, including lower-cost patent application services, reaching out to communities that have historically not been involved in patenting but certainly are inventing. So we're doing lots of things. And, of course, one of our core businesses is simply training our lawyers at Howard, which is 85% black students, who are interested in IP, that this is a viable opportunity for them, which until we started the Institute, we really didn't have many law students going into IP, and now we have quite a few.
So, Eric, across the country in Silicon Valley, are you starting to see the ripples of this kind of discourse come up in legal analyses and decisions involving intellectual property law?
I think we started with the premise that intellectual property are commercial rights, that businesses acquire them because they are going to go make more money. And a lot of students come for that purpose, and a lot of lawyers focus on that, and I think that's great. But we are increasingly seeing students who have reservations about the way the intellectual property system is working and what ends it's advancing. And we're looking for outlets for that. So we've certainly been in tune to that. We've done an increasing number of programs with our Center for Social Justice and Public Interest here in our law school that are designed to bring together the social justice community with the intellectual property community and talk about ways in which we can learn from each other.
That's great. Evan, had you seen these two sort of disparate schools of thought come together before in your own practice?
Well, not so much in my own practice. I mean, I am, the type of clients that I represent are generally commercial entities, business owners. So, I don't, get into those issues dealing with social justice all that much. But what I do, what I have experienced is exposure to Professor Jamar's work, having been at conferences and stuff like that. And so it's very intriguing to see this. And of course, anytime that there is such a cogent and well thought out approach to improving the public good. I am all for that. So it certainly makes good cognitive sense to me to take these principles, these notions, these norms, and put them into or plug into them the ideas of intellectual property and the role that plays in society. So apart from seeing it in my own career, I certainly am aware of it as a thinker about these kinds of issues and a participant in the discourse that goes along with these things, and think that it's a great thing.
So let's take this to a concrete level and give some examples of how it might play out if intellectual property law were to be considered against a social justice backdrop. Another article you've written, Professor Jamar, has to do with social networking and the Copyright Act, and proposes revising or reinterpreting the Copyright Act in ways that would be more friendly to the users of social networks and the users of online services in general. It seems to me like your proposal is to make intellectual property law apply and benefit not just large patent-holding entities or movie studios or other large creative entities, but everyone who might create something online. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. It's always difficult when people actually read your work and you have to defend it. That's, but I would say our watchwords for IPSCA are really inclusion and empowerment. And we want to not just bring social justice as a concept into the IP discourse, but we want to empower historically marginalized communities to use intellectual property law and intellectual property that they themselves create for their economic advancement and economic empowerment. So the sorts of things that Evan is talking about, and Eric is talking about, we actually are very big into that. In fact, we have a chapter in a book coming out in June on IP and development and IP and empowerment. So what we're looking at with the article on social networking and copyright is the copyright law, if it's applied too rigorously, will stymie the ability of people to generate work, particularly what are called derivative works, building on what's out there, and then to exploit that new work. A lot of times, these sorts of derivative works that are online are done for non-commercial reasons and yet would be illegal under the IP laws. But also, many are done for commercial reasons and don't have a substantial impact on the underlying work. One of the best examples of this is simply the Harry Potter encyclopedia, where someone took all the Harry Potter books, put together an encyclopedia where you could look up names and so on to find out who they are as you forget as you're reading the books. Well, that could be, and in some ways is, a derivative work and could be just stopped completely by the author of Harry Potter. You can now go online and find the same thing for there's a wiki of Fire and Ice, or what's it? The
Song of Ice and Fire. Yes.
Yeah, the Game of Thrones. So you have that same phenomenon happening. Well, there's all this stuff online. Well, they could shut that down if they wanted to under current IP law. Our proposal is that those are good things. People should be able to make money through an advertising model online. People should be able to exploit that sort of thing. And if you expand your derivative works right too much, that will adversely impact. We should keep those entry costs low for this sort of work so that more and more people can become involved and entrepreneurs online.
Great. So some of the things that you're proposing seem pretty radical, but also, I mean, they would be a radical change from the way we've seen the law operate now, sort of in the DMCA era, where things get posted and then you go through this dance of whether they're going to remain up or not, and whether or not fair use is going to ride to the rescue and keep them up there. What you propose is revising or reinterpreting the Copyright Act so that you should be able to lawfully post links to and post portions of copyrighted works without permission, a broad right to create and disseminate derivative works online for non-commercial purposes, and a right to create derivative works for commercial purposes if the new work is original, it's transformative. So it's basically taking some of the fair use factors and making it more of a sword than a shield, if that makes sense, sticking with our Song of Ice and Fire analogies. Am I getting that right?
Yes, and trying to make it more certain. We want one of the problems is if you have to go to court to prove your fair use, it becomes an expensive proposition, and those with the most money win. So we want to sharpen that law, reduce, like when we took parodies of music, we said, oh, that whole area now is free and open for people to make parodies without permission. Well, that's the sort of idea here that and fair use was created by judges too, to allow this sort of work. But we should have more precision about what is allowed and what is not allowed so that more people can do more. And we ought to trim our derivative works rules substantially. So I don't view it nearly as radical as it might sound, except perhaps as it's going back to more what was intended and what the law was prior to the 1909 Act and what it is in many other countries. So I don't view it as that radical. Certainly it's not the same as what big media and big content providers want, though, however.
Right. Eric, what do you think about all of this? It seems to me like an excellent idea, but that just may be from my own unique ideological perspective. It also seems to me like something that would be very difficult to accomplish.
I think back to January and the battles we had over SOPA. The opponents of SOPA largely shut down the internet. I know it's a little bit of an overstatement, but largely shut it down. And all we did was preserve the status quo. And as it turns out, the status quo is still massively out of whack. The copyright owners are able to exercise their rights in ways that are hard to defend from any logical perspective. So I love the idea of going on the offensive against the rights owners who've gotten who've swung the pendulum too far. I don't know that's the reality of our political economy. It was a huge win for us to kill SOPA, but the counter proposal, which for example, the open bill as a substitute for SOPA, A, that didn't go anywhere, and B, it was still going to expand copyright owners' rights. So the political economy is so stacked against our ability to carve back all the rights that we've been handing off to rights owners. I don't know how to fix that. I love the idea. I wish we could make more progress on that.
Evan, what do you think? Are you for this, and how does it move ahead?
I would like to see it just for the sake of simplifying things. If the fair use factors were more meaningfully codified in the Copyright Act, I mean, they're there now. They're set forth, but it's still set up to where it's an affirmative defense that you've got to raise, and there's no presumption that a particular use is going to be fair. Just using this as an example, there are other ways that kind of remix culture things in copyright law are put on steroids by Professor Jamar's proposal and thoughts on these things. But I would look at it not only from a good for the public interest perspective, but also just for the the streamlining effect and the lessening of resources that would be needed to resolve some of these questions about how content can be used in subsequent iterations and how much from the copyright protected the universe of content that there is out there can be used meaningfully without worrying too much about what the ill effects of it are going to be. The biggest one of those ill effects would just be the cost of having to defend oneself in a lawsuit and trying to raise, fair use arguments. So there are a number of different ways to support this idea of bolstering these things, to do with copyright law, not only from the social justice perspective, but also from pragmatic economic interests as well. They would not be mutually exclusive.
All right. Well, we've been talking about sort of lofty issues. Let's move from the sublime to the ridiculous, if we can, and talk about what happened at South by Southwest with the use of homeless folks as internet hotspots. Got written up in the New York Times. People were wandering around providing extra Wi-Fi capacity at the, of course, Wi-Fi stretched South by Southwest event. BBH Labs was behind this and employed a bunch of homeless folks to go around and provide 4G hotspot access to folks who were nearby them. And they were paid and they could be given tips as well by the conference attendees. And this just rubbed tons of people the wrong way. A big debate ensued over, okay, well, so you want to just use these people as homeless hotspots. And then on the other hand, what? You want to deprive them of income. So people were definitely up in arms about this. And Evan, I think you cut right to it in your very succinct tweet that you could... The IP ramifications of this really should be at everybody's fore because, of course, if you're using your homeless hotspot to engage in your nefarious downloading and torrenting, then it's going to be really hard to serve a subpoena on you. So I think that you you actually, you know, I think you were tongue in cheek when you put that up, but I think it's an interesting twist on this issue that folks could be very well taken advantage of and used for purposes that, you know, would be a lot less palatable than supplying Wi-Fi to a conference. So let's toss this to Professor Jamar. Did you watch this unfold and do you have any thoughts on it?
I haven't followed it closely. Particularly not from the IP aspects. I just think that the social justice aspects are fairly simple, that if you're going to do this sort of thing, why do you do that? Why don't you invite some of those homeless in and give them some training to use the internet instead of just be a telephone pole? And I really think that it's so exploitive. It's frustrating in on many, many levels. I don't have much more to say about it. It's one of those things like we're trying to help these people and you're paying them less than minimum wage to stand around your building with a t-shirt on.
Right. And someone in IRC is asking us to specify what the t-shirts actually said. I'm looking at the photo in the New York Times story and here's Clarence. His shirt says, "I'm Clarence, a 4G hotspot." So...
The dehumanizing of that.
Exactly.
The dehumanizing of that is not that my name is Clarence and you can get 4G through me. It's just I am a hot... I'm sorry.
Yes. No, it definitely was... you're not the only person that found this deeply offensive. But on the other hand, you know, there was a... You're right. The implementation certainly was bad. But how about the concept in general? What do you think about this, Eric? As you know, we have botnets out there. What about human botnets of this variety?
So believe it or not, there's actually a word that was coined last decade called bumvertising, where homeless people would be recruited to display advertising for third parties on their signs, otherwise requesting handouts from strangers. And on the one hand, you might say that's actually brilliant, right? If you pay them for that advertising, they're getting money directly rather than having to solicit it. But the exploitative nature of such a campaign suggests that we have certain limits about what's right and what's wrong in dealing with getting the word out to people. And it always struck me that the bumvertising concept really took the ubiquity of advertising to its logical extreme and showed us that it gets ridiculous at that extreme.
Right. Evan, were you tossing out your notions about shielding nefarious downloaders as just sort of a joke, or did you think that this is something that we might actually see more broadly implemented?
Well, when I tweeted that saying that, you know, it was that the fear is of the plaintiff copy, you know, copyright plaintiffs not being able to effectively fight privacy. My comment was more of an indictment of big media copyright plaintiffs and other copyright plaintiffs who file not well-founded suits. You know, as far as the whole question of the exploitive nature of it or the purported dehumanization of it, I mean, I recognize this is a pretty sensitive issue and people have gotten pretty upset about this, but I have a hard time seeing really what the big deal is here. If you look at how, you know, our marketplace works and how we engage in economic and social transactions with one another, it's all pretty exploitative, isn't it? I mean, I've got to come to work, and if I choose to not do my work, then I get fired and I don't get money. You know, the big boss man doesn't write me a check. Dependent on, you know, doing that, even if it's against my will, if I don't feel like coming to work, I've still got to do that. You know, and then there was this discussion about, and I guess I would add to that, nobody's going to say that I am being dehumanized because I got to come to work in order to get money to buy groceries for my family. Some other people were saying that there was this stark contrast between the people providing these services, the so-called you know, human hotspots, homeless hotspots, and those who were there patronizing them, and patronizing in the negative sense, not a pejorative sense, but the ones giving them money or donations in return for access to the hotspot. And I thought to myself, well, again, you see examples of big, stark contrasts in terms of socioeconomic status or educational status or any other kind of indicia of status. You see interactions, transactions like that all the time, and you don't think anything of it. I mean, even all of us who are you know, well-educated and can talk about these issues intelligently and consider ourselves to be, you know, in that stratum of learnedness and our professionalism and stuff. I mean, I'll just come out and say it. I'm a, you know, kind of an affluent white guy. If I'm, you know, going to be engaging in some kind of transaction with, you know, a bank and looking to get a loan for some kind of major corporate capital investment, I'm dealing with, you know, billionaire or, you know, multimillionaires and billionaires. So there's a huge disconnect between the style of life that I have and the style of life of many of the commercial enterprises out there. And nobody's, and I don't go around thinking of myself as dehumanizing. I guess what I would be looking for in the analysis is some kind of inherent difference in the type of social interaction and economic interaction that's going on between these homeless people who are there voluntarily. They're not being conscripted into this. What's the fundamental difference in kind in that kind of economic transaction versus any other kind of economic transaction which we all have to participate in just to be, you know, members of the society and the economy that we're in today? That's why that's why I'm not sure it's such a big deal.
Okay. Well, it was certainly newsworthy this week. Another thing that was is that Yahoo claims to basically all your Facebook are belong to us, says Yahoo. They claim that a vast majority of Facebook's infrastructure is founded upon Yahoo's patents. And they're going after them, which is an interesting thing to do in 2012, I think, given that Facebook has been around since 2004. Not that there's a statute of limitations that bars patent claims, because there's not. But it just, it's interesting timing, new CEO, all that. What do you think about all this, Eric?
It is really interesting, certainly in our community here in the Silicon Valley, but I think more generally nationally, people get really excited when the big Silicon Valley giants go after each other. There's some certain blood sport excitement to it. You know, patent litigation is no joke. It is a heavy hammer that that plaintiffs use to try and control marketplaces or to extract cash that they don't deserve. And in this case, we're still trying to figure out the legitimacy of Yahoo's position no doubt Yahoo is taking advantage of the broad and ambiguous patents that got through the patent office over the last 15 years. They may have run into somebody who's actually willing to point out that those patents are not enforceable and willing to spend the money. I think the more interesting thing is what it says about Yahoo internally to its employees. There was an interesting post by one Yahoo employee saying that he felt he got used, that he was encouraged to write patents, but he always thought they would be used for defensive purposes. And he was upset that they had been weaponized, a term I really liked.
Yes.
And, you know, internally within Yahoo, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if the engineers there are saying, A, we don't buy software patents. B, we thought we were accruing them for defensive purposes. And C, this looks like the effort of a company that's going under, that's grasping at revenue from somebody else because it can't make its own. So it sends a lot of messages to the Yahoo's lawsuit sends a lot of messages to the public, but it also sends messages internally to its employees. And it strikes me that this is a dangerous lawsuit for Yahoo, regardless of outcome.
Yeah, I would add D to your list of points. If you had all the technology to implement a Facebook, all the know-how and patented knowledge, then why didn't you implement Facebook?
Well, that's not the way the patents work, right? The idea is that someone's supposed to come up with a good idea and it's up for others to figure out how to execute on that, but only with the idea creator's permission or with payment to them. We know here in the Silicon Valley very clearly the difference between ideas and execution. And unquestionably, where there's a tension between the two, always pick the person who's going to execute better. Better execution beats better ideas 99% of the time. So we know that Yahoo couldn't execute on these to do what Facebook's doing. Frankly, nobody else can either. Google is desperate to emulate Facebook. They can't even do it. So we know that, but that's not what the patent law encourages or supports. And it's a sign of the times then that Yahoo may be using its ability to generate a patent, but not its ability to generate a new business line as a way to try and get a piece of the action.
So this is just the latest in a large high-profile patent suit in the technology world. Professor Jamar, is your institute also working to reform patent law? And do you see any hope that that has any success?
We haven't taken particular positions on most of patent law. Both Latif and I are not patent lawyers. We're on the copyright, trademark, publicity side of things. And there's only the two of us, and we actually have full-time jobs as professors. We do have a patent lawyer on staff, and we have started to take a look at this. So we were in favor in general of the Patent Reform Act that went to first file, and we were in favor of a variety of the patent office initiatives to reach out to the marginalized communities. In terms of, I have my own personal views on the patent law, about what should be the patentable standards, whether software should be patented, and so on. But that's our institute hasn't taken formal positions on that. I think that with respect to the Yahoo, I think that the comments were dead on. It was fairly interesting. We had a panel on patent trolls, so-called, at our last CLE. And there was a sense among the Federal Circuit judges and the patent office and these high-end attorneys that there was a series of about 5 years where pretty low-quality patents, particularly in software, were issued, and that those are starting in another 5 years, will be expiring, and that we'll see a dramatic reduction in this ability of those people who are not exploiting the patents themselves, but are just trying to exploit them through licensing, those lawsuits will start to diminish. And what we're sitting on with Yahoo, I think, is a number of those same kinds of patents. That is to say, patents that are pretty low quality, I'm all in favor of this lawsuit. I hope they take it to judgment, because I think from the little I know of it, I don't know the details of the patents, but the people I talk to, these are going to be thrown out, or a lot of them will be, and that will be a good thing. I personally much prefer the model of a company like Reddit, Reddit.com, by Alexis Ohanian and his friend Steve, who, and it's all done open source. And they say, hey, you can take our entire software and jump in and compete with us on quality. And I think that for so many of these businesses, like Facebook, like Yahoo, like Google, and so on, the patents should not be playing any sort of significant role in it. That the playground should be, can you do the product? Can you deliver it better? And I think that, you know, in our profession, Lexis and Westlaw should not be getting much in terms of patent or copyright protection, and in fact don't. It's, can they deliver a service that puts them in a position where we're willing to pay for getting cases that we can now get for free elsewhere? And a lot of lawyers are, and I am through my law school, because there's value added that makes it worth it. Another one would be, instead of using Expedia or Travelocity, you could use HipMonk, which is, again, an open source software. And my favorite part of that one is that it ranks airlines by agony. How long will it take you to get there, and how many layovers and all the rest, not simply by cost or whatever. So there's all sorts of things out there, business models that are working on advertising business model that are not dependent on the IP. And I think that is something that should be looked at very closely by Congress. I don't see any path forward.
Evan, in the Marketing Land article that we have in our discussion points, Greg Sterling points out the timing of this is somewhat analogous to what happened before Google went public and Yahoo sued Google for patent infringement over AdWords, and wound up reaching a resolution with Google that now seems like something that, you know, is just a tiny drop in the bucket compared to what they could have gotten had they stuck with it. Do you think that this is just kind of a shakedown, or do you think that Yahoo intends to really plant its flag on these patents and push forward?
Probably a little bit of both. I mean, is there any other reasonable thing for Yahoo to be doing right now other than suing and trying to, you know, stake some kind of claim into this gravy train that is social media, social networking, that Facebook rocket that is continuing to accelerate? Whatever. You know, it's, you know, Yahoo certainly has this in its playbook. We've seen that with what it did with the Overture patents and with, you know, like what you were talking about, how it sued Google in 2004. Facebook is, this would be the most inconvenient time possible to sue Facebook. So if, and also, you know, Yahoo has the new CEO. So, you know, he's got something to prove in all this. He's not going to just take that office and then just be, you know, business as usual at Yahoo. So he's got, you know, in a certain sense, has nothing to lose by taking an aggressive position in all of this. So, you know, it really just seems like it's the natural thing for Yahoo to be doing in all of this. And the ultimate issue for Yahoo is to get Facebook to talk about these patents, this intellectual property that's at stake here, whether they're strong or whether they're weak or whether the patents are good or going to get tossed out or whatever. Yahoo has got to engage Facebook in talking about these things. And with Facebook being so busy with other stuff, you know, namely the IPO and stuff, you know, filing a lawsuit is the only way to, like, say, look, Facebook, we're serious. We really want to talk about this with you. And we can't wait a few months until the IPO issues are resolved, because then it'll be too late for us. They wouldn't come out and say that. But filing the lawsuit is the way to really bring Facebook into the same room and get them to talk. And it's almost like Yahoo has to do that, or otherwise they're irrelevant, not just in the patent world, but in the overall world as it is.
All right. Well, I look forward to the Aaron Sorkin script for the movie. And I'm also thinking that maybe Facebook should start to patent something that prevents people from being shaken down for their passwords and made to divulge the things in their account that the public otherwise couldn't see. This apparently, according to the allegations in the complaint, happened to a Minnesota schoolgirl in middle school there. She's 12 years old, and she had some stuff on her Facebook account that her school wanted to see, and she alleges the ACLU is backing her in a lawsuit against the school district. She alleges they brought her in and intimidated her into giving over her account passwords so that they could see what she had written about an adult hall monitor that she was having some issues with. And then she posted something else about, okay, who ratted me out about posting about the hall monitor. So she had various issues that the school wanted access to her account to see. The school claims, of course, that her lawsuit is all one-sided, doesn't tell the whole story, and that when all is said and done, a court will certainly agree that their actions were reasonable. But it does just sort of rub me the wrong way instinctively that a 12-year-old could be made to, well, first of all, I don't see this mentioned in the story about this lawsuit that we're looking at here. But if she's 12, she's not supposed to be on Facebook to begin with. So there's a terms of service issue there too. But in any event, that she was forced to give over her password and divulge this information seems disquieting. Eric, any thoughts on this?
The battle over passwords to social media is just out of control. And I think 5 or 10 years from now, we're going to look back and just shake our heads saying, were we crazy at the time to require people to turn over their passwords to their Facebook account? The analogy might be closest to requiring someone to turn over their passwords to their email account. I can't really think of any good reason why someone should have the right to dip into my email account. A, they shouldn't be allowed to speak on my behalf, but B, they shouldn't be allowed to read the things that are in the email account that aren't relevant to anything. And social media accounts are just an overlay on top of email. They allow all kinds of messaging between people. Some of that is unambiguously public. The things that I put out onto Facebook, on my wall that I have open to the public, those are fair game for everybody. But there's plenty of material in my Facebook account that isn't open to everybody. And getting access to my Facebook password is totally illogical as a way to get for anything. There was an article by Bob Sullivan at the Red Tape Chronicles at MSNBC. I'll post it to the chat room in a moment. That talked about how job seekers are being told that they have to hand over their passwords to their social media accounts. So, for example, in Maryland, job seekers applying to the state's Department of Corrections have to turn it over so they can be scrutinized. Student athletes in college are being asked to turn over their passwords to their accounts so that the athletic departments can monitor what they're saying and doing. And of course, in court, we've seen judges order litigants to turn over their passwords as part of discovery, in many cases exposing completely irrelevant information to litigation to their litigation opponent. This is all crazy. And I know that we're going to look back and shake our heads and think we were nuts at that time.
Yeah, it does just seem like a completely out of control situation. We've covered it before on the show with police officers in Texas and among the litany of other folks that you just mentioned, Eric, being subjected to this. Professor Jamart, is there any way of stemming this tide?
First thing I want to say about the Minnesota case is that I will bet that one of the facts that will come out is that her parents were the one who were sitting in that meeting with the girl, with the principal, and ultimately gave permission or told the daughter to turn it over. I don't know that. If the parents weren't involved and it was just the daughter being forced to do it, then I think the school's got some serious problems. But you have that whole level of parental involvement and parental control. She probably was on Facebook with her parents' permission. But all that to one side. I think that the issues for adults, for discovery, for these other things, I think we have a real privacy regime problem right now online in this country. I think that the 50-page privacy directive from the Obama administration shows that it's still essentially you have to opt out as opposed to opt in. The attitude of Google with combining all of its privacy regulations. I think that that whole realm of what is private, what is not private, how should we allow access, how should we tailor our discovery, how should we tailor our legitimate criminal investigations of these, how should we protect it when there's these discovery fishing expeditions, those are really difficult problems, actually. I remember, you know, from when I was a litigator, I surely did not want the other side to simply say, oh, these are the 14 documents that are relevant to this lawsuit. I wanted to go look at the 40 boxes of documents to see the whole development of the product, to see what was going on, to so that I could find out is, you know, what were the other relevant documents and find if there was one, a smoking gun. So I think that there are some difficult problems here, balancing discovery in the civil litigation, disclosure, and balancing the criminal needs, the criminal investigation needs. I think we're going to see a regime of protective orders, limited discovery. I think we'll be seeing motions to court saying, no, they can't get the password. They can only view this parts of my website or something. I think it's a problem. I agree that with Eric that we're likely to be moving forward on this in 10 years having resolved all this. But that's the way the IP issues and the privacy issues have been working. As they come up, it takes us 5 to 10 years to work them out. You know, at first we didn't know that video games were actually going to be protected by copyright because they didn't seem fixed and you had the input by the author. Well, a number of courts seem to be messing around with that, and finally they came to the conclusion, yeah, it's fixed enough. I think we'll see that same sort of thing happening here, though I expect to see legislation ultimately dealing with privacy, and I hope that we revamp our whole system in light of what is technology. I would expect that by 2025 we'll see all of privacy law and all of IP law really taking into account in a significant way that we have the internet, and we have these technological things out there that are simply were never dreamed of when all of this was first developed.
Yeah, the reporting that I'm looking at on this is from CNN's Wire staff, and they say they don't actually address the issue of whether the girl's parents were present. It seems to imply not, because it says the officials did not have permission from her mother to view her private communications. So I would think that that means she wasn't there saying, okay, honey, give him your password. But we'll just have to see how this unfolds. It does strike me as a strange and wide open area of the law. I love your reminding us about the development of video game law. And yes, I think that courts are still trying to figure out how all this works and the interplay between speech and privacy that social networking brings to the fore. We were talking last week about the guy who made a comment on his Facebook page and was ordered to publish an apology about the comment on his Facebook page. So court-ordered speech there. Evan, do you think these two instances make a pair? And what do you think about the whole notion of forcing a student to disclose passwords?
The idea of forcing a student to disclose passwords is kind of in a category of inquiry on its own that I think is safely set apart from the larger questions of when it's appropriate, for example, to allow opponents in discovery to see the other side's social media accounts, allowing access to that. Because, you know, when we're talking about students and their constitutional rights, whether it be the First Amendment rights or the Fourth Amendment rights that are implicated in facts like this, you know, there's a whole special framework that the Supreme Court has given us to work with here. And you know, in the last few years, Justice Thomas, for whatever reason, has kind of taken this on as a little specialty. You know, there was a case, I mean, it all kind of starts out even pre-Thomas, you know, a case called talking about the Fourth Amendment, at least, you know, Vernonia, which had to do actually with TLO. There's a case called TLO that goes all, that was all the way back in the 80s. I think it was 85. And this sets out this standard for if a school's going to search do a search that would implicate the Fourth Amendment on a student, they've got to have a reasonable suspicion. And that's a lower threshold that has to be showed, you know, for the average citizen out there, not in school, you know, that being probable cause. And, you know, I mean, there's been some cases where it's been found that it was a Fourth Amendment violation to do searches. There was a case in 2009 from the Supreme Court called Safford. And, the, you know, the facts in that case were a middle school girl was suspected of actually, I guess maybe she wasn't really suspected because part of the issue was they didn't have a reasonable suspicion, but they thought she had ibuprofen, you know, Advil, on her person somewhere, and they did a strip search of her, essentially, this 12-year-old girl, I think, and the court held that that was an unreasonable search and violated the Fourth Amendment and all that stuff. So it's very different when we're talking about the school here and whether to turn over these passwords. And even with that less restrictive test for Fourth Amendment searches, I think in this situation, granted, we just have the plaintiff side of the story in this Michigan or Minnesota case. So, you know, there's going to be all kinds of stuff that comes out to really like what she was doing wrong and how she gave rise to the suspicion. You know, the best I can tell from Cashmere Hill's piece on this is that she was talking about sex in something else, in, you know, some of her other messages and all this stuff. So then there's the, this kind of flows nicely into the First Amendment issue. There's a case called Tinker from the 60s that talks about the First Amendment rights the student has. So there's a lot, there's a whole potpourri of issues that go with this school analysis that's separate and apart from the larger questions of discovery. And, you know, being, you know, I practice litigation, I'm involved in discovery of social media information all the time. I honestly, from here in the trenches, don't see much of a privacy issue in all this. The courts seem to have been pretty clear that when you're seeking discovery of an opponent's social media information, you just got to show the same kind of relevancy standard and the same kind of standard that's out there to get any kind of information from your opponent. Courts aren't willing to treat social media accounts separate differently, you know, from a privacy standpoint, but you do see other sensibilities come into play that affect that analysis. So to summarize, I see the school issue as separate and apart, subject to its own analysis, rather than lumping it in with the larger questions of the privacy that we have in social media that everybody has.
Yes. I'd like to talk just for a second about the First Amendment aspect here.
Please.
You know, the most famous case today for school speech is Bong Hits for Jesus, where a student was outside on the street, put up this meaningless poster, Bong Hits for Jesus, when the Olympics Olympic torch was coming through down the street. And the school suspended him because it was advocating drugs and was against the school policy for drugs. And the Supreme Court said that, in fact, that was a school-recognized event and the school could have a no-tolerance policy there. But notice that this speech by that student, Bong Hits for Jesus, in a big sign, was public. Here, it seems to be very hard for me to see how the school has any interest that can get them to this girl's speech any more than they can take away her her notebook that she has at home or her diary or all these other things that she has at home. Where's the school's ability to go get those things, even if she's talking about sex, even if she's talking about all of these things that the school doesn't want her talking about? Because as far as I read the story, she wasn't posting on the school's website or the school's Facebook account, and she was just posting, you know, like a text message or a passing a note to a friend, and not even in school, perhaps. So I think that we have some First Amendment issues there. That what could be the reasonable suspicion that the school had that there was something illegal going on here? You know, defamation, maybe, doubtful, doesn't seem to be like that. So I think that the First Amendment side gives rise to all sorts of problems. And again, I agree with Eric on this, that there's very specific issues and very specific aspects to the child and school case that don't spread across all the other areas. Each area has its own meaning and problem. This one is very, very problematic under the facts that we have.
Yeah, I agree. And I suppose that's why the ACLU is involved. And hopefully they will flesh out all those First Amendment issues, and we'll get some clarity on the point. Because I think the, again, the CNN reporting that I'm looking at on this does specify that the equipment she was using was her own and not the school's. And as you say, you know, there has to be some zone of conduct that a student can engage in that is separate and apart from the school's ability to reach. So we'll see where that goes. Let's switch gears here a bit. I know you guys probably remember Zadiva from a few months back. And then there was IVTV, both services coming along in the wake of the Cablevision case, trying to make some hay out of being able to time shift and offer DVR sort of services for a subscription fee on users' behalf. IVTV specifically was involved in capturing broadcast television signals. Now we have something called Aereo that is also trying to see what's going to be permitted under the law for that. Aereo, and I will preface this discussion by saying that I think none of us probably, you know, it's a conundrum for anyone to think about. I don't think anybody, any one of us could look at this, the facts of this case or the underlying legislation governing the cable industry and be able to say, oh yes, this is absolutely something that's going to be out of line and tossed out, or hey, you know, they've got some wiggle room here. I think it's a real gray area. But what this company, Aereo, is trying to do, it involves teeny tiny antennas and providing a teeny tiny antenna for each and every one of its users that would be like the great big television antenna, rabbit ears, that you might have on your TV or on your roof to capture broadcast television signals. And what Aereo wants to be able to do, if it is permitted to remain in business, is to outsource that antenna function for you and be able to be your antenna and then take what you have captured on your teeny tiny antenna and send it to your mobile devices. The cable industry doesn't like this. Aereo is being sued. And it may be the next to go the way of Zadiva and IVTV, but we don't know. They are well-funded and may have a prayer here. So I bring it up just because it's interesting to watch these forays into using broadcast television and getting it out to people in the ways that the television companies themselves are not doing. Eric, any thoughts on this?
The legal analysis is too complicated even for me. I'm waiting to see how it all hashes out. More generally, the battle is really over the fact that users want to enjoy content at the time and place of their choosing. And that's the one thing that the major content industries refuse to give consumers. So the hacks that we see to try and give consumers more power to get the ability to consume content at the time and place they're choosing, things like little antennas to pick up broadcast TV, etc., are just a reflection of the fact that consumers will find a way to get as close as possible to what they want despite the best efforts of the major content industries.
Yep, so we'll have to see if this one works. Evan, do you think they have a prayer?
In the IRC, Sybil echoed my thoughts exactly, because I was thinking perhaps the only thing that Aereo could have done worse in this was to give these little teeny tiny antennas to homeless people, and then they let them be the ones that rebroadcast or do whatever it is with that. So I'm with Eric, man. If Eric Goldman doesn't understand the legal analysis of all this, who am I to say that, oh yeah, well, the critique of the retransmission, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to do it. I'm not even going to go there.
I know. My apologies to Colin in our studio who asked that we talk about this week. The legal side of this is just a mess. And I'll just throw into that mess the fact that there is some legislation that was introduced in December by Congressman Scalise and Senator DeMint called the Next Generation Television Marketplace Act that is designed to try and give some clarity to what people can do with television signals and try and let market forces have a better, bigger role there and deregulate the retransmission of content. But who knows where that will go. I'm sure that it has a lot of strenuous opposition. And I don't even know that it would save this company's business model. So Denise, I'll see. Stephen? Yes, please.
Can I put in my little social justice spin on this?
Please.
One of the things that we're concerned about with our institute and social justice is that we not have IP laws that unduly restrict or limit this sort of innovation, that restrict our technology, that are so favored to keep established business models in place that we are stymieing our ability to move forward, and particularly for those marginalized communities. If you're talking about getting television at $12 instead of a month instead of at $160 a month, if you're looking at all these different technologies that are available and are going to be coming on down the pike, particularly when we're looking at cell phones and 4G, and if we just keep it to the three networks that are involved and we don't let new entrants in, all of these have social justice implications, particularly for the marginalized communities, for people wanting to enter that market in, let's just say, a few block area of New York where they want to use this sort of technology, where they want to get out. So I think we see a whole complex area of law involving intellectual property, communications law, our whole regulatory scheme that is currently still favoring, you know, big media, big business, and now today, big internet, if you will. And we should be looking at all of these issues with a social justice lens that says, what about the smaller guy? What about that whole entrepreneurial side that allows that small entrant in, that allows the use of such technologies? And that is a, you know, I don't know about the merits of this particular case under current law, but from the social justice, you know, 30,000 foot perspective, that's what I see, is that this sort of thing is being stymied in many, 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 many ways across the board all the time in many different fields. And that is a systemic problem that we have.
And folks in IRC are wondering how this is any different than Slingbox. I think that the way it functions is different. This, you know, capturing, outsourcing the antenna function thing, I think is a bit different than the way Slingbox is. I don't have a Slingbox, so I can't really speak directly to how those work. But it seems like Aereo is adding another layer of a third-party service that's going to capture and then redirect your content wherever you want it. I know that sounds just like what Sling does too. So maybe there is a parallel here. So let's move on to one of our favorite topics. Whenever we have Professor Goldman on the show, the latest and greatest in Section 230 law and how that is standing up in the courts these days. You have The Dirty as a case that you've recently blogged about, Eric. Can you give us in a nutshell what's new and fun and interesting as far as the protections afforded website owners for third-party content on their sites?
So for the few of you who haven't dealt with the law, 47 U.S.C. 230 says that websites aren't liable for third-party content. There are a couple of statutory exceptions, including intellectual property and federal criminal prosecutions. But otherwise, the law is clear, and it's been fairly universally applied with minimal exceptions to the immunity. We had a good example about that recently with a case involving a Montana resident, Spreadbury, who sued a newspaper because the newspaper had written an article about him, and then users had posted comments to the online version of that article that he thought were defamatory. He went into court against the newspaper. The newspaper said those are third-party those comments are third-party content. There's really nothing to discuss here. And the court said, of course, there's really nothing to discuss here. Website wins, plaintiff loses. So we just had another one of those cases that I think is a really clean application. We've had two more interesting cases where we've had some adverse rulings that have been distinguished or overturned. We had a case involving StubHub, which allows, obviously, users to sell tickets to each other. And there's been a variety of lawsuits against StubHub for breaking anti-scalping laws because the tickets are priced more than their face price or because there are service charges added above and beyond what the statute allows. And recently, StubHub got a very favorable ruling under 47 U.S.C. 230 saying that the fact that users were selling scalped tickets at a higher price wasn't StubHub's problem. And then we just got another ruling involving The Dirty, which has a number of different types of content publishes, but it's best known for a place where third-party users submit a photo of a person, often a woman, and some gossip about that person, usually involving sex and perhaps other illicit activity. Once that photo and comment are submitted, the operator of the site, a guy who goes by the alias Nick Ritchie, will post it, and then he'll add his own snark to it. He'll say something usually derogatory about the person in the photo. A number of the people depicted in the comments, the photo, and the user supplied commentary, have sued The Dirty for publishing the photo, publishing the comments, and then in some cases for adding the snark at the end. And The Dirty lost a pretty significant ruling back in January, where the judge said, "I know that the photo and the user supplied comment came from a third party. But because of the way your site is architected, you're still going to lose. You're responsible for that third-party content." That was just a lawless ruling. It's inconsistent with the statute. We just recently had a new ruling against The Dirty by a different judge in a different court that said, of course, The Dirty qualifies for Section 230 immunity. The other judge in January who said they didn't got it wrong. We've had in the, just the last couple of weeks, I think three really nice, clean applications of the statute, reinforcing that unless judges go rogue and break the law, websites aren't liable for third-party content.
Okay, thanks for bringing us up to speed on that. I guess we could call this Evan Taco Suit Corner because we've got a couple of suits that are reminiscent of Nilay Patel's term that he coined here on the show, talking about suits against folks that were akin to suing Taco Bell for its bad meat, that we tend to use that as shorthand for class action suits that clog up the courts and maybe shouldn't have been brought, but are interesting nonetheless. You know, they're colorable claims. The AT&T one, I was interested to find out that one of the folks aggrieved by AT&T changing its terms for unlimited users to actually start throttling their use, this person decided to sue in California in small claims court, of all places, and won $850, which is kind of brilliant. You know, now he's got this determination against AT&T, and now AT&T is, you know, apparently the person's not being quiet about it, has come to him with a letter suggesting that they settle, apparently also threatening to cancel his phone service. Apparently he was using his phone for tethering, which violated the terms of service, so maybe they have some basis there that has nothing to do with him actually getting a judgment against them. But AT&T would like him to reach some kind of accommodation with them. So one interesting development there. And then also there's a suit now by someone, let's see, his name is Frank Fazio. He's in New York, and he is bringing a class action against Apple for false advertising pertaining to Siri. Now, of course, we've all seen the Siri ads where Siri is basically sweeping into your life and making things kinder and gentler in so many ways and taking care of so many of your problems. And what Frank is contending is that, yeah, well, Siri doesn't work anywhere near as well as these ads would have you believe. We'll show you a bit of one now.
Where's the best barbecue in Kansas City?
Is there a rodeo in Amarillo today? Where are we?
Here's your current location.
How big is the Grand Canyon?
Any gas stations we can walk to?
I found two gas stations fairly close to you.
What does Orion look like?
I found this for you.
Remind me to do this again.
Okay, I'll remind you.
So, I don't have Siri yet, but it does look like a wonderful world to live in when Siri is your guide through life. But apparently, Frank says it's not as well as it's not all it's cracked up to be. And he's suing Apple for false advertising over this. Evan, what are your thoughts on this?
I think he's got a great case, and I think that just about any producer, any company that's making products in the consumer market is really at risk here, because these commercials, not only do they often misstate how well the product itself how well the product itself works, but they also misstate the effects on your life. I mean, I'm really mad because, you know, when I look at those people, I'm not even one tenth as hip, you know, not even a fraction as attractive. My life doesn't, you know, contain as much, you know, happiness. I don't spend the end of the day, you know, staring wistfully with my arm around my significant other, looking at the Pacific Ocean. So yeah, I am really angry. This is more than puffery. They're saying a lot here, making promises they can't keep. I think everybody ought to get a check.
But yes, Evan, at least you have a good radio voice.
That's good. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Wow. I think Eric just told you had a face for radio, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, he already admitted that he doesn't look good, but I think you look great, personally. But, you know, I was trying to find an attribute that you had overlooked.
There's enough love to go around on St. Patrick's Day, isn't there?
Yes, indeed. It was Joe Palazzo writing about this in the Wall Street Journal, who said that they asked Siri about this. When asked whether her makers exaggerated her worth, Siri told blah blog, "We were talking about you, not me." She says that a lot, they say.
I think that I'm still waiting. I bought a Cougar and a Ford Cougar, and I'm still waiting for Farrah Fawcett to show up. I mean, you know, I think that there's a lot of this that's going to be just ordinary hype. Advertising is going to be allowed. But when you're doing consumer products and they're actually showing people talking into Siri, and I have it, and Siri does all these wonderfulness for you so easily and so perfectly, that becomes much more of a straight up warranty by example. And mm-hmm. It's not simply, you know, puffery, or your life will be magically changed and you'll be young and healthy and all these other wonderful things. And so that's where I think they have some vulnerability, particularly on the consumer side, the consumer law. I think that, you know, disclaimers aren't going to really help them there, because they've made essentially what amounts to an express warranty by example. I like Siri, except the problem I have with it is how it eats up incredible amounts of bandwidth. So I pretty much never use it. I don't have that much of a need for it. It is kind of a magical thing, but until we can resolve the bandwidth problem, where AT&T is going to charge me umpteen million dollars for my gigabytes, I think that's a serious problem. And I think that's actually a big basis for a lawsuit, is that there wasn't a disclosure that, oh, it's not all happening inside the phone. It's all happening now with this, all the processing is happening somewhere else and back and forth and giving you all of this data and the maps and so on. It's a real bandwidth hog. So I think that Apple has some real vulnerability from those commercials.
So Denise, I'm sorry. That one I'm not sure I agree with. And I think the analogy is that it's a little bit like trying to sue Google because it didn't give you the search results that you wanted. Google certainly says, we got the best search results we can give you. We do all these things in order to make the search results better. Clearly, they're trying to portray themselves as a quality purveyor of search results. But we all know that not every search is going to give us what we want. And, I didn't see anything either in that ad or in the advertising that gave me any different apprehension about the quality of the search function of Siri. So I don't quite see it nearly as clear a case as you might.
Yeah, it seems to me like if the case is asserting that there's an issue with the quality of the service provided, that they're probably going to be out of luck. If the case is with the fact that the service is not actually being provided, then maybe they've got something more to talk about. If they can show that, when I go to use Siri, it just simply, not only does it not work as advertised, it doesn't work. That then there could be something more to talk about. I think that there's a lot of countervailing evidence that people love the product and it seems to be working for them. So, it would be an uphill battle. But I know that if we're just talking about, the functionality of a product, and you could, I suppose, ultimately get into safety issues with it as well if you're relying on it for something in a life-threatening circumstance, then, you at least want it to have some chance of actually connecting you with 911 or whatever it is you're trying to reach. So I think that'll be an interesting one to watch. Definitely, I put it in the taco suit category because it's kind of funny, and Evan definitely, I think, encapsulated that it's a fun case to think about bringing, but I think there's a nugget of something to discuss there. So we'll have to watch it and see what goes on with it. Let's move on to our resource of the week, which is the Institute for Intellectual Property and Social Justice at Howard, Professor Jamar's own project there. And as I said, it's a great resource. They're doing good work. It's got a short-ish URL. Otherwise, it will be in our show notes as well at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/153. But you can find them at iipsj.org. And they write, "What if social justice was a pill that was patented and could save the lives of millions of people but never reach those people because they are poor? What if social justice was a song with a copyright, but the people who created the song couldn't sing it without paying someone else? What if social justice was a trademark, but it was used on products to pollute urban communities and oppress the poor? As our world becomes ever more dependent upon technological and scientific developments, we will be forced to engage issues of access. In addition, we will be charged with giving inventors, artists, and entrepreneurs the tools to exploit the economic value of their creative works and inventions. This is the work of IIPSJ." So thanks, Stephen Jamar. I encourage people to check out that project and use the resources there. We also have a tip of the week for you. And our tip is that if you would like to make sure that you're adequately informed on all of the privacy issues that impact your life as you go about your online business, The Atlantic reports that will take about 3.5 months out of your year. If you were to sit down and actually read through all of the privacy process, would take 76 work days. This is Alexis Madrigal writing in The Atlantic, penciling out that the hypothetical national opportunity cost of reading privacy policies comes out to $781 billion per year. Eric, I believe you wanted to weigh in on this.
It's a cute little parlor trick to compute the number of hours that someone would spend making decisions in the marketplace. But if we wanted to be fully informed consumers on everything that we purchase, we would come up with similarly vast numbers. Think about if you're trying to buy stocks in the marketplace, the amount of information that's disclosed and the length of time it takes to figure that out is enormous. Or if you wanted to do the research on something like, car tires and figure out how to understand the implications of that, it would also take enormous amounts of time. And so we understand that we aren't going to read all the things that we sign up to in the privacy policy context, just like we don't do fully informed decision making on all the things that we purchase in the marketplace. I just found it a little bit distracting to try and come up with numbers like that, knowing that we always take these heuristics. That's just a part of coping with life.
I guess, yes, you could extrapolate this out and calculate all the numbers if we were to actually read, you know, the documents involved in leasing or buying a home or buying a car or all of the other sort of major and minor transactions in our lives, we would have no time to live those lives at all. But it's also sort of ludicrous to think that those documents then have meaning. If we're all just going to say that, okay, we're not going to read these things and it's just the social bargain that we make, then why have them in the first place?
You recall that both Judge Easterbrook and Posner admitted that they didn't read the documents in their loan transactions. It was just too hard even for them.
Right. Stephen?
Denise? Yeah. I think that there's a couple pieces I want to point out here. One is when we have that problem that we're talking about, you get Congress to pass the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act so that we don't have to read it, so that we know that the warranties mean something, so they're not all disclaimed with legal terminology. We get state lemon laws for cars. This is why we have certain legislation that constrains what vendors can do with contracts. And this sort of data helps us to see what sorts of things maybe we should be addressing. But we've done this before. We'll do it again. I think it indicates that maybe this is an area where, because people can't spend the time reading this, maybe it is an area where we should have the federal standards, the federal regulation, the non-derogable provisions, whatever those might be, that all policy, all privacy rules with respect to commercial transactions have this, and you can't change them. I don't see that happening anytime sooner, but that is one of the responses here that we have traditionally used in this sort of problematic area, where the freedom of contract, the individual responsibility, the idea of, oh, just let the buyer beware and give the buyer enough information, simply is not workable in a modern complex marketplace, including on the internet.
Evan, any thoughts? Go ahead, Eric.
I just want to point out, I think that's right. I agree with Steve. On the other hand, I would point out that part of the reason why the privacy policies are so long is because the legislators continue to require new information to be added to the privacy policies. So in some sense, the legislators have compounded the problem, not solved it.
Evan, any thoughts on setting aside 3.5 months of your life? There we go. Yes, it's good that you could make time for the show.
I just had some markups on this one that I looked at a couple weeks ago. So I don't know what the big deal is. I'm getting ready to actually get started on my New Year's resolutions in earnest as soon as I get through reading these privacy policies. It's already mid-March. We'll be there soon. I'll get them done soon.
That's right. No and negotiating deal. Your proposed changes there too.
That's the hard part. I got to hire an agent to do that for me.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe Siri can handle that for you.
Yeah, right.
All right, guys. Well, this has been really, really fun and a great discussion. I'm so glad you could all join me today. Stephen Jamar, it's great meeting you. Great having you on the show.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
We've really enjoyed it, too. Folks can, of course, find you at the Institute for Intellectual Property and Social Justice. I know you're on Google+. Anything else you'd like to plug or anything else you'd like to point people toward?
No, I think that you've done all the plugging that I could dream of with a little IPSHA.org. My homepage is at IPSHA.com/SDJ, but the website proper for our institute is IPSHA.org.
Wonderful. Thanks so much once again. And we look forward to having your colleague, Latif Matima, on the show soon, too.
Yeah, I'll have to tune into that to see what fireworks happen when Mr. Levine responds to our critique of his book.
Yes, I'm desperately trying to get them on the same show, but Mr. Levine has just told me that he has now a scheduling conflict, so I'm going to have to see if I need to move them around, but it would be wonderful to have the two of them on together, so I'm working on that.
Yeah.
All right, Professor Goldman, great to see you again.
Always a pleasure. I'm always grateful for the chance to be here.
Wonderful that you could bring us up to speed on everything that's going on in Section 230 and elsewhere on your blog, which, of course, is one of the best legal blogs out there at blog.ericgoldman.org. Anything else going on at Santa Clara you want to let us know?
All kinds of good stuff. Please encourage your listeners and viewers to check out our website, hightechlaw.scu.edu. And sign up for our blog or Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn accounts, and we'll keep in touch.
Let's do that. And of course, you can follow Professor Goldman himself on Twitter at Eric Goldman. He's on Google Plus too, as Google strives to get its social network on a par with Facebook. You know, for those of us who use Google Plus a lot, it definitely has its own charms, separate and apart. Evan, we can't find you on any social network, so we'll just plug you over there on Twitter. Internet Cases on Twitter, internetcases.com as well. One of the other wonderful legal blogs out there that will keep you up to speed on everything you need to know about internet law.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, everybody, go read that. Follow me on Twitter, Internet Cases. And Denise, happy birthday this week coming up.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, that's next week coming up. I'm much more excited about St. Patrick's Day, I got to say, than my own birthday. But that happens as time goes on. But I appreciate it. Thanks very much. And I've really appreciated having you all on the show. It's been a really fun one. We will see you next week on the next episode of This Week in Law, which we record Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC. Please join us at twit.tv if you like to watch live. Otherwise, you can find us on iTunes and YouTube and the various ways. Of course, you can find us at twit.tv/twill as well. You can email me between the shows. I'm Denise at twit.tv. I love getting your input and suggestions for what we should discuss on the show. You can do it via email, or you can find me on our Facebook page or our Google Plus page, and I monitor those too. So thanks very much, everyone. We'll see you next week.